In her private chambers, her attendants waited to undress her and comb out her long hair. When they were done, she dismissed them and sat for a moment before the hearth. It was summertime, and the fireplace was empty. Behind her, she heard a woman's voice. "You have caught him." "Oh, yes," said the queen, without turning her head. "I have caught him." "Be cautious," said the other. "Do not offend the gods." The Queen of Atolia was first published in April of 2000, 4 years after The Thief. It launched Megan Whalen Turner's as-yet-unnamed series in earnest, although it was controversial with readers, provoking at least one angry letter written in purple pen, according to an interview she gave with Publishers Weekly in 2010.
"The most stylish way to write angry letters, rejecting that plot twist out of hand."
But Megan's hands were tied at that point. So right off the bat, it achieved the goal of all literature for young readers, which is upsetting children.
And, in doing so, inspiring them to prose, which I think we can call a win. Anyone else feel like writing an angry letter? Show of hands?
I'm Noelle.
I'm Caitlin.
And I'm Chip.
And this is the Atolian Archives, Book 2. We have three people now, and we're here to get you through the now four-month wait for Book 6. It's December 2nd, 2018, which means that The Return of the Thief is in only 107 days.
When we think of this book, we usually think of the unhanding as happening right off the bat, but it actually doesn't happen until Chapter 3. Chapter 1 only takes us through his capture.
So I have in my hand the 2006 paperback, which we've already talked about how those are generally our favorite covers. And for Queen of Atolia, that means the shot of Atolia's kind of chest and hands, and she's holding the hook and almost pricking her finger with it.
And we're positive it's not a water bottle.
Chip said that it looked like a water bottle.
It does sort of look like a water
bottle. I will
never
be able to unsee that now.
Yeah.
Now, she's just... She's
waterbending.
She's brought her Nalgene.
Yeah.
In her dungeon.
Yeah. Listen, you gotta stay hydrated during capital punishments. It's key.
But there's also the original cover, which has Jen and Atolia together on a boat. And she's looking at him, and he's kind of leaning against the edge of the boat like, hey...
Because he can't sit properly ever.
Yeah. So at the beginning of this chapter, he's hiding in the palace in Atolia. But at first, it might be unclear that they're even in Atolia. I know you were talking about that earlier, Chip.
Yeah, I was thinking about if you're reading this, like, say you just picked up this book, you haven't read the first one, to actually, you know, they refer to a queen multiple times in this chapter, but she doesn't get referred to as the Queen of Atolia until she actually appears at the very end. And the palace could be anywhere. And even if you've read the first one, all you know is that it's probably Jen and he's in a palace, but we haven't actually placed it in Atolia until like three quarters of the way through the chapter. So that's kind of interesting.
And that makes it maybe unclear as to the extent of the danger that he's in until you realize that this is Atolia. Because they had that whole unresolved thing where she was definitely going to try and get him again, and it definitely wasn't going to end well for him. And when is this?
We know it's in the middle of summer again, and I think we can be sure that it's a year after the thief because, well, two different things. First of all, in this chapter, the narration says that Atolia knows that Jen has moved through her strongholds at least four times in the past year, like leaving her little notes and once exiting the room right before she went into it and going through her room while she sleeps. And so that indicates that it's been 1 year since the thief, because before that his political involvement wasn't really that strong. Someone later in this book says to Jen that in the space of a year he became Edis's biggest folk hero, which I think includes stealing the gift and getting his hand cut off. So mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure this is just a year after.
Yeah.
And he's been leaving her notes and going through her room because that's totally a normal thing to do.
Just leaving earrings. Like, I thought these would look nice on you, but I'm not going to speak to you. I'm just going to leave them in your bedroom while you sleep. Oof.
Because if you found me, you would murder me.
Yeah, this is a healthy dynamic we've got going.
We're really starting on a high note.
I want to know what the notes say. Are they love letters?
No, because she had no idea, so they can't be. Like, she's as shocked as you are, as the reader, when he says, I want you to know that I love you. You can picture her going like, excuse me, what?
But the thing about Jen is this is his character. You can imagine these notes as just being little, oh, I thought you looked lovely in the gardens. You know, things that would be, he might consider compliments, but if you're, like, just reading them are just expressions of his own, arrogance.
Yeah.
And you know that she would be taking whatever he says as an insult.
Like, yeah, as mocking her.
Yeah. There's no way she would have interpreted anything he says in a good light, in a non-mocking light.
Well, she views him as a tool at this point, as a tool of Edis's, and one that she desires. Yeah. She expresses that in the previous book, but that's all he is. And maybe that's all anyone is to her at this point, are tools that she can either use or be used against her.
And this book, right off the bat, is very different from The Thief because it's in third person, and Atolia and Jen are both perspective characters.
Which I think is a really good way to introduce Atolia in this book, because she's obviously, so far, she's been the biggest threat, so I think this is the only way that readers could really I guess come to terms with Atolia's relationship with Jen later, is only after a book of having her as a perspective character and getting inside her head.
But even when she is the perspective character, we don't always know what she's feeling.
True.
And we're not really with her. So she is isolated and cut off from everyone, including us, mm-hmm. who she should be most, like, we should be her when we're in her point of view, but we're not. And so you get the feeling that maybe she's even removed from herself and mm-hmm. from looking at and recognizing her own feelings. She's so far from being able to express her feelings, she can't even express her feelings to herself.
She can't even recognize them.
And this is such a strange way to start that relationship too, right? Is her hunting him? I mean, well, we have their interaction in the previous book, but this book is, I feel, fundamentally about this relationship yeah. between these two characters, and it's gonna turn into something, but it's really hard to get behind that as an objective reader, to be like, yeah, this seems like a cool, healthy relationship that I can personally be invested in. And yet, going back and rereading, after having read the entire series, you're like, yeah, I'm rooting for these two crazy kids.
I don't know if I was quite horrified, but I had very mixed feelings the first
time. Oh, absolutely.
Time. And now that I do go back and read it again, I feel exactly that way. I'm totally on board with it.
And I think it was only after reading King of Atolia that I really got behind their relationship. Because at the end of Queen of Atolia, I think I kind of felt, reading it the first time, that it just came out of left field.
Mm-hmm.
And they have all this bad history, but you don't get to see any positive parts of a relationship between the two of them, because there basically isn't one at that point. So King of Atolia was what really made the difference for me. And then when I went back and reread Queen of Atolia, I think I was more invested at that point.
And that's a breakdown of a conventional structure of fantasy stories, because so often we get a romance and the end of the story is they get married, and then everything after that is a big blissful blank.
Mm-hmm.
But in these books, the majority of our understanding of this relationship happens after they are married, and everything that happens then illuminates what happened before.
Mm-hmm.
Something else that struck me on this reread, after having read Thick as Thieves, we know that Jen spent an unspecified amount of time masquerading as a servant in Atolia's palace, mm-hmm. long enough to get to know Kamet. So I was kind of surprised that, I was just kind of wondering, like, how on the one hand is he being hunted by soldiers and a queen who knows what he looks like, yet also managing to blend into the crowd and live there for maybe even a few months at a time without
He's a sneaky boy.
Yeah.
He's a very sneaky boy. And the thing is, this is a way of maybe highlighting the class dynamic. Yeah. Would Atulia be looking at her servants? She's barely looking at anyone.
And Jen is set apart by his ability to talk to and, recognize the value of people who other people overlook, which is really important when it comes to Kamet, because nobody would have looked twice at Kamet or thought that Kamet could be important. And Jen understood how important he was and what he could do.
Mm-hmm. But is he... And that's an interesting thing to dive into, because he's developing that relationship before this book even starts, chronologically. Is he already planning to use Kamet to take down the Medes? What is he doing? Or does he simply develop these relationships and then use them later because, that's what a normal person does, is develop friendships and then asks things of those people?
Good question. I would say, I think at this point, I would say the second one is more likely because maybe once he gathers more political power and becomes the king, then I think he would definitely at least look at it more in that light. But, maybe it could have been the first one.
Part of the long game.
Yeah.
But the you have to ask how long that game is. What are his goals? Before he gets captured, before, hand atrocities are committed, committed out of hand, what are his goals? What is he going to, just hide in this castle until Atulia falls in love with him? Is that the plan?
I think that pre-unhanding, his plans are very fluid and vague. And it's during his recovery process that it solidifies into what he wants to do. That's my theory.
I think that makes sense. Also, I think pre-unhanding, wasn't he... the reason he was in Atolia's palace was he was spying for Edis. And it's never really specified what information she was looking for, but wasn't that why he was there?
Yeah, he was in service to his queen at that point.
Yeah.
And I think he was probably eager to do it because of his feelings for Atulia.
And that... Jen is put into this position of being between Edis and Atulia as political rivals, and these are two people who he has very strong feelings about in very different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a conflict that he's having that we don't really see except in retrospect. And then he's forced to pick a side, essentially.
Yeah.
And he picks Atulia. Which is both a triumph and something that's very sad.
He picks Atulia, but he has a grand scheme for choosing every side. I think fundamental to Jen's character is this idea that he can have it all. Even, and maybe part of this book is his recovery to that point.
Mm-hmm.
After finally being cut down, after being cut down to size by Atulia, he can...
Cut down to size.
Yeah, I'm slipping in as many of those as I can. he comes back a few pounds later and he has to kind of get back to this point where he says, you know what, I can do whatever I want. And I think at the beginning of this book, his plans are fluid because he feels like he can do anything.
Oh yeah, he definitely feels
invincible.
Totally invincible.
Yeah, at the beginning, he's not even worried when he hears people stampeding above him, looking for him.
Because he's gotten out of this kind of thing before.
Right. And he just assumes until the very end that he's going to. And he almost does, to give him credit. It takes divine intervention to trip him up.
Sometimes God puts a big wooden board in front of your face.
And if that ain't me every day, I don't know what is.
And I remember in the blurb on the back of Queen of Atulia, which usually blurbs are not to be listened to, but it describes, in a vague way, it's trying to hint at what's going to happen. And it says that his greatest triumph is also his greatest loss. And I think that he can have it all, but there's also, in a lot of Jen's development, an element of, in order to win, he has to lose things emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
And, he loses who he is, not only when his hand is cut off, but when he makes the decision to become King of Atulia, he'll never be the Thief of Edis again, and he'll never have the same relationship with Helen that he used to have, and he'll never have the same relationship with Sophos that he used to have, and he'll have to be king, and so he has to sacrifice a lot of what he wanted and loved in order to achieve what he wants to achieve. And there's no success mm-hmm. without some kind of loss or compromise.
Well, and here's my question, because it feels like what he's working to is picking every side of developing, you know, I'm talking series-wide, he's trying to develop a force against the Mead through unification.
Yeah.
And that's what he's working towards. And in a way, isn't he still trying to have it all? Isn't he still trying to say, hey, I'm looking out for Edis, I'm looking out for Sunis, I'm looking out for everyone?
Well, yes, definitely. But I think he's still, like, he's trying to have it all, but I think he can't, as Numal was saying, he can't have it in the way that he used to. Like, he can still keep Edis and Sophos in his life, for example, but their relationship has to change as he pursues those goals. So I think you both have a good point.
And Jen is forced, in order to achieve that, in some ways to become the villain. I mean, he put Sophos in a position where he's backed into a corner, and he essentially takes over his country. Mm-hmm. And they still love each other.
Boy, oh boy, do they.
But there's a power dynamic that wasn't there before that Jen isn't entirely comfortable with.
And he does the same thing with Kamet.
Yeah.
Also, is that before, when they knew each other and became friends, they were equals, more or less, and then things shift, and Jen is the one who has the power to upend Kamet's entire life, and they have to deal with that in their relationship and see if they can move towards something else now that things have changed.
And this renegotiation of relationships is maybe a turning point in the beginning of this book as a coming of age.
Mm-hmm.
As you become an adult, you are forced to make decisions about your relationships that are very real and will have very final consequences for, you know, the duration of those relationships. And Jen is being forced to make those decisions. He's becoming an adult. This is no longer a fun road trip where you might die, but it's still, we're going to have a good time. It's now adulthood.
And something that I've always appreciated about this series is Megan Wayland-Turner's commitment to consequences. Mm-hmm. His hand gets cut off, and he begs the gods for it back, and he's not going to get it back. He has to adjust, and he has to accept a new reality and a new image for what his life is going to be like, which is much more of a portrayal of a real experience than if there was a deus ex machina for real. I mean, there are a couple of deus ex machinas in this.
But they're not ones that feel unsatisfying or ones that feel like you've been cheated out of consequences in that way. So another thing on this rereading is, in the middle of this chase scene that's very high in tension, and Jen kind of narrates that the first time he slipped into these secret passages in the Hypocaust, he was much smaller and he was a child, and his grandfather had brought him to Otolia, but his grandfather had had to stay behind in the town because he was too big and too old for the passages. So that was kind of touching, that in the middle of this we see this family moment. But also, whenever I hear about his grandfather, I'm just kind of shocked that an adult let his child do this.
Yeah, I'm gonna go drink. You go have fun. Maybe don't get murdered.
Like,
climb up on this rampart.
Right.
You'll be fine.
Which is exactly what killed your mom.
Oh boy, yeah. I didn't even consider that.
There's a lot of irresponsible childcare in these books.
Whole lot.
And like, obviously, you get the sense that Jen's dad at least was the responsible adult saying, "Don't do that."
Yeah.
But like, can you imagine sending your 6-year-old, your 8-year-old, whatever, not only into an enemy palace, but like, go climb around the plumbing? And if you get stuck and I don't hear from you, I can't really do much about it.
Yeah, Jen always complains that his dad wanted him to be a soldier, and that's not the life, you know, that's a crazy, you gotta kill people, and here he is at, what, the age of, like, how old do we think he is when he made these trips? Like, 10, 11?
Yeah.
He's
definitely preteen.
Gotta be small.
And, you know, it's, like, his dad was the responsible one by training him for the army, you know? That's kind of a interesting dynamic.
The options are all violence related.
They certainly are.
And I think we've talked about this before, saying that, you know, the army is not a safe choice, but Jen's dad at least would have had Jen more under his eye, and maybe there would have been more accountability, so he might have been safer in that way, but, like, still not that much safer.
Yeah, and Jen would have been less unique. As it is now, right. He is the one of him, mm-hmm. and everybody wants a piece of him.
And Atolia gets
namely
it.
Namely his hand. This chapter also has an offhand mention of Talaeus. Talaeus gets introduced in this chapter, but kind of just in passing, which is very cool.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a point. This is my first reread of this book since I went through the series about a couple months ago. And, you know, to come back and see Talaeus that early on is shocking. In a couple chapters, we're going to get a bunch of guards named and we're never going to see them again. But Talaeus, obviously going to be a major character, a major player in these coming books.
And that's another example of the people who seem insignificant end up being central.
I'd love to talk about this idea of abandonment by the gods and who's on whose side, mm-hmm. in terms of divine intervention, because as we will later find out, it's Moira in the room behind Atolia.
Yeah.
We end this chapter with Jen praying and not being answered. And having had too much of the gods in the last book, my question is this a relief or is it terrifying?
It's definitely an instance of be careful what you wish for, right? Because he spent all of the thief being like, go away, I don't want to talk to you, just leave me alone with your magic and your fancy rocks. I don't want anything to do with it. And now he actually needs them and they're not there. And what's really disturbing is the idea that his suffering is part of their plan.
Yeah.
Moira says this is the path you gotta walk.
Yeah.
And that's a difficult thing to confront, that your suffering had to happen. That there was no way around it. And maybe that's a part of adulthood too, that there's a certain amount of suffering that you have to confront.
That's chapter one. Next episode, things continue to hurtle towards disaster for our boy as Atolia takes matters into her own hands.
Send us your comments, questions, and thoughts. Chime in at atolianarchives.tumblr.com.
Be blessed in your endeavors. The gods have abandoned him, which is what he wanted, question mark. Maybe we should say this in the form of a podcast instead of just like muttering about it.